Did you see the stylish kids in the riot? Shoveled up like monks at the night on fire, wombles bleed, truncheons and shields. You know I cherish you, my love.
Welcome to the Young IPA Podcast. I'm James, this is Pete.
G'day everyone.
It is the 15th of June and it is episode 64 of the podcast. And we've got a huge show for you guys coming up. We're going to be talking to IPA Campus Coordinator Renee Gorman, one of our favourites. She recently was speaking at one of the IPA Generation Liberty Capitalism v Socialism debates over at the University of Sydney. So we're going to be talking to her about that and what the debate was like and a few other stories that are coming out of universities where, you know, people have just lost their minds. So we're going to get
crazy week for the unis.
That. Yeah, unis have been on brand this week. And we're also going to be talking to IPA Director of Strategic Communications and External Affairs. I nailed it. Stuart Eden, about some of the red tape work that the IPA has been doing recently and also his trip to America to see the Washington Capitals and what he was sort of picking up from the political conversations he was having over there, especially about the North Korean talks and occupational licensing. So that's a lot of fun.
We had Kim Jong-un lined up, but he cancelled late, so we got Stu in.
Yeah, he had a very important meeting he couldn't get out of. We don't know what that was about, but we'll see what happens. But let's talk about that. So,
should we introduce
Nina, pressing the buttons as always. Well, thank you for being here.
No worries. Thank you for having me.
That was extremely organic. Thank you, Peter. Cool. So let's talk about these Trump-Kim talks. So this was the big story of the week. What was going to happen? What was going to be the outcome?
Yep.
I just want to say, like, show that photo to yourself 4 years ago.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, President Trump and Kim Jong-un shaking hands. That you would never have believed it.
You could almost imagine it as, say, Trump wasn't president. Say he was just Trump, the first Trump.
Yeah, yeah. Just
you could see, like, oh, yeah, he'd do something crazy like that.
Yeah, yeah. Just like he's building a condo and beyond. I think he said, like, this would be a good area for a condo. I could be wrong about that with all the fake news that is flying around. But anyway, so we should probably talk about it. So what did you make of what you saw?
Well, I'm no expert, James. This might come
okay,
as
we'll
used
move
to
on.
this might come as used to you that I'm no expert in international relations.
Yes.
So I just go on what the media said, and that sort of had two different viewpoints. The first one was that that this was a good thing because it's opening up to diplomatic relationships with this country that's been a pariah state. And the other one was it was bad because we shouldn't be we shouldn't be talking to these people without them making concessions first on their behaviour. Those are the two views.
Yeah, yeah. So it's like they agreed to make, North Korea agreed to make concessions, but there's a whole lot of things like the US are making more concessions and there's no evidence that North Korea is going to follow through because they haven't with past ones. For me, it was really weird. Like, you know, I get the art of the deal and I get negotiation and stuff like that. But it's like when you see Trump say,
well, you are a deal maker.
I'm a deal maker. I'm a king maker and a deal broker and other kind of words. But it is weird seeing like Trump stand up there and say like, you know, Kim, like the quote is like, Kim loves his country and he's really smart. And you're just like, this is a little weird. Like Reagan would absolutely clown Soviet leaders to their face over what the Soviets were doing to their people while at the negotiation talks.
Okay.
But, you know, I didn't love that.
Yeah, yeah. I hear.
Yeah, but I guess, like, everyone was freaking out 6 months ago because it was, like, you know, the Rocket Man talks and people were freaking out that we were on the brink of war. So it's crazy that, like, 6 months later they're at the table making concessions with each other.
Yeah, that's good too.
Yeah. Cool. So if you want to read some more about that, so we sort of had like two articles in Hey, What Did I Miss Yesterday? One from Reason that were praising the talks and one from the National Review, which were a bit more critical. So you can sort of weigh them up for yourself, see what you think.
Make up your own mind.
Yeah.
Can I draw your attention to a little bit of media coverage of the talks though, James?
Go ahead.
The ABC, our wonderful broadcaster, national broadcaster, reported that in the press packs, there were USBs in the press packs given out to the press, but that journalists shouldn't use them because there might be malware on them. Thanks for that, ABC. And the BBC put a video up of Trump awkwardly trying to shake the hand of one of the generals, and the general salutes first and then shakes his hand.
Well, so that's the main takeout. So
thanks for that, BBC.
Yeah, so that's our serious analysis done of the North Korean talks.
That's your razor sharp.
Yeah, let's get into the funny stuff. First off, Dennis Rodman, why aren't we investing in Potcoin?
Well, I have.
You have? Good. Because I have as well. I didn't want... I took some of the podcast funding that we've got here.
Yeah.
Because like on the Potcoin website, there's a for business section.
Is that right?
If you guys missed it. So Dennis Rodman was in Singapore. He's trying to help out with the talks. And at every media event, he was wearing a shirt that just said, invest in Potcoin.
Did I? So explain
if
that...
If you thought you had trouble explaining what Bitcoin was.
Yeah.
Try explaining Potcoin.
Well, it's just Bitcoin for
I think
drug
it's Bitcoin
dealers,
for
it?
Drug dealers. Yeah. Yeah.
And so...
But that is going to appear in a history book one day.
Yeah. Imagine like in 300 years time, like is the textbook and these kids are like, who is this figure and what is Potcoin?
Well, the caption is going to be Dennis Rodman wearing a shirt from Potcoin attends peace talks between President Donald Trump and North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un.
Yeah.
That is a Mad Libs section
and
for the
like,
ages.
You know, discuss.
Discuss. Yeah. Right. What do you make of it?
Well, yeah. So Dennis Rodman was big.
Yeah. And he got a call from Sarah Huckabee Sanders saying, thanks for all your efforts.
Really?
Yeah. We know this because he played it on speakerphone device, which I'm sure she was briefed about.
Imagine like her phone list at the start of the day. Yeah. Wait, what? Yeah, you have to.
Cool. So other ones we saw. So I don't know if you saw the image. Kim Jong-un rocked up in a limo surrounded by joggers who were so his security guards are all in suits. They have to run around the car at all times.
Yep.
My question is, how on earth does that make him safer?
Well,
because if you've got 10 cars and you're like, you know, you usually got decoy cars. If you've got 10 cars going to the thing and one of them surrounded by 10 joggers, I think I know which, if I'm an assassin, I know which one Kim's in.
Yeah, exactly.
So that was crazy. And I like all their form. Like they've got a very good, like they've got their running down to a T. It seems to be in sync, which is very cool.
When they show movies of North Korea,
the
people in North Korea all like walk in tight. It's a very militaristic.
Oh, this is another thing I wanted to say. So everyone, like, you know, there's already the idea of like, I can't believe we're legitimizing the North Korea by doing these talks.
Yep.
Meanwhile, like 6 months, or legitimizing praising, like 6 months ago at the Winter Olympics, wasn't everyone freaking out about how charming Kim Jong-un's sister was
at
the Winter Olympics?
Yep.
And like how cool the...
The cheerleaders
just like doing their song was, and everyone's like, oh, wow, their sister, she like side-eyed Mike Pence, completely fooled him.
Oh,
and
yeah, great.
Yeah.
She's.
But also, we shouldn't have talks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I don't get that.
I think there might be a bias in the media, James.
Oh, really?
I'm starting to think there might be a bias in the media.
The other thing we saw, sorry, this story came out of Salon. Kim Jong-un bought a port-a-loo.
Here we go. This is good.
This okay, I'm so, like, you this know, is people gross. Might be listening to this over their morning coffee, and I'm sorry. I apologize.
It's but gross but important.
It's gross but important. If you want to skip the next 2 minutes, I don't blame you, but please come back when you want to because it's important stuff. Kim Jong-un bought his own port-a-loo because he doesn't... All right, so apparently he brings it to every event. I've looked into it.
Nina's lost it.
Look, okay, bear with me. So he brings this port-a-loo to all of events. Okay, so this came from Lee Yun-kyol, a guard who defected from North Korea in 2005. He brings all of this because the... It contains his business.
Passing.
Contains information about his health status. They can't be left behind. And they bring a portable toilet so that they will deny determined sewer divers insights into the Supreme Leader's stools. What is he hiding? That's one of those ones where you've made too much of an effort to hide something that no one was thinking about.
Yeah.
And now everyone's thinking about it.
I can't stop thinking about it.
That's all I thought about. I can't sleep at night. And I also like this. So this port-a-loo thing has finally got international attention because it's the first time anyone's seen it because it is the first time Kim Jong-un has flown out of North Korea as leader.
Okay, yeah, yep.
Which means, did the joggers follow the plane? Like, are they jogging alongside the plane or are they like sellotaped to the side just to protect the king?
Got to keep it safe.
Got to keep it safe.
So.
All right, cool. Let's move on to another story.
You're not going
to
do the pants?
Oh, yeah. What was going on with the pants? I don't know if you saw them, but like Kim Jong-un was wearing... Pants that were like suited for Nat 5. He looked like he was wearing MC Hammer pants.
Yeah.
Anyway, again, visual gag in an audio podcast. Look at those pants. Send me an email. We'll discuss the pants.
Yeah.
They have been occupying my mind for a while as well.
Communists wear funny clothes.
Communists do wear funny clothes. All right.
So the other big story this week was the story that came out of Melbourne, the Victorian College of the Arts put on a performance called Where We Stand by a student called Isabella Mason to highlight how Indigenous people and people of colour have been excluded from society and history. So what occurs at this show is that, so it's like a theatre sort of dramatic production. When you walk into the foyer, they divide people up by race. People of colour go inside and people who are white stay outside, get lectured on their white privilege, you know, blah, 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 blah. And then when they can't enter before they sign something saying that they agree to that, where their privilege or whatever, actually I don't know what they sign something, and then they go in And once they arrive at their seats, the play ends, right? And this is supposed to prove how Indigenous people were discriminated against historically, etc. Now, this has drawn a lot of reaction. A lot of people saying this is stupid. It's dividing people on race. It's very controversial. My take.
It is literally dividing people on race.
Yeah, I mean,
that is literally what it is.
It's hard to reject that claim. Yeah. So my take is that a lot of people said this is really bad. I think firstly, there's no problem if a theatrical production wants to explore race, fine, go for it. But what I disagree with is this takeout from the University of Melbourne's Faculty of Arts and Music acting dean John Catapan, who said that the production was provocative and exciting. This isn't provocative and exciting. This is what every...
This is just stupid.
Mm. Yeah, this is just stupid.
Yeah, that's, you tell them, Nina. You tell them.
But also, every single thing that humanities departments do is always about race and gender and class.
Yeah.
How is this provocative? This
but
is
also,
what you do.
If I went to this play and it ended the second I sat down, I'm not excited.
Yeah.
I'm a lot of things. I'm not excited.
We're not really happy it's over.
Do they know that they're part of the play or...?
No, well... Like,
I'm assuming they only know that there is an audience.
Yeah, the people that talked to The Australian did not know that that was going to be part of it.
That's true.
And they were like, I'm a little weirded out that I have to sign something before I come in. Yeah, my thing is, like you say, if a show wants to explore race, fine. And if a show wants to segregate audience members, I mean, I have problems with that, but the idea of, like, they shouldn't be allowed to do that, I don't care. Like, it's their play. They can do what they want.
Go for it.
But where it does get it tricky is, like, it's at the Victorian College of the Arts. That's taxpayer-funded, and it's taxpayer-funded venues. And then it gets a little murky because it's like, is this a VCA? Well, obviously, the person from the University of Melbourne's like, this is provocative entertaining. But it's also, like, VCA's co-opting that. Like, they're saying that this is a good policy. We'll have it at our venues.
Yeah.
Just through having it there.
So once it's taxpayer money coming into it, it's always open to debate.
Which is why get rid of taxpayer funding. Because then you can do this. You can do this all you want. Just don't rely on taxpayer funding.
That's a very interesting idea, James.
Thank you, Pete.
But I've got another takeout.
Go ahead.
So this is how society might look, right, in a few years if people still keep getting taught things like this at universities. Or this is at least how universities might look in a few years. So I think people should go and find out. If you're on the fence about you thinking whether or not universities are stupid and so we talk about how bad universities are at the moment, right? If you're not convinced by that argument, go to this play and find out how society might be in a few years.
Yeah, exactly.
Because the quotes from this bloke who gave his quotes to the Oz,
the person attending,
the guy who just, this is the punter who attended, you know, he talks about it was like the Cultural Revolution. We all had to declare our racial the people were declaring their racial pedigree. You know, these teenagers were telling us how we should be overcoming our white privilege. That's how things might look. So go.
Yeah.
Experience.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, you should be the director of advertising. And I think Nina is going to go from that shake of the head.
That's okay.
I'm not a fan of
that. I have something on that day.
I'm still going.
Cool. So we'll run through some. So a huge week for the IPA. We've had like 8 op-eds in the last 7 days of Hero Papers all over the country. So make sure you're on our website reading them because there's a whole lot to get your head around. We've got stuff from John Roscombe talking about the University of Sydney versus the Ramsey Foundation. That was a really cool article that came out in the Australian Financial Review today. We've also got Dr. Chris Berg and Professor Sinclair Davidson talking about the ABC. That's also on our website just after their book on why the ABC should be privatized came out. You also got Bella De Brera on the show last week to talk about her article on at uni with Mrs. Potato Head, which was in the Spectator Australia. She was also in the Australian Financial Review about the ANU versus the Ramsey Foundation. So make sure you guys are reading that. But I want to discuss one particular article. Might not be the best. won't be the best written. but the author is with us now, Peter Gregory.
Yeah, so I had an op-ed this week.
Yeah, tell us about it.
Okay, so it's in the Spectator Australia, and it was actually about foreign aid.
Yes.
So it was about...
Tell us a story, because it's actually quite interesting.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you, James. That's a real compliment.
Yeah, now that I've got the digging out of the way, I actually enjoyed the article.
Okay, that's great. So
put me up to a polygraph. I enjoyed the article.
Okay. If you had read another of my articles, you know the polygraphs are a very flawed test, but... So Rwanda, I can't remember if it's president or prime minister, Paul Kagame sponsored British football team Arsenal for $20 million, and this caused outcry in Britain because they're like, we give Rwanda £20 million, £63 million in aid while they're sponsoring a football team. And my article just points out that actually a lot of countries would be better off if their governments just use the money they get in foreign aid to sponsor footy teams or burn rather than, for... What's the word? Consolidating their own power, which is what happens a lot with foreign aid. But read the article.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's available on our website.
And me and Morgan, we owe each other a beer every time we have an op-ed. So Morgan owes me a froth.
Yeah. And how many do you owe Morgan?
We've started this week. So
you don't count the past.
All right, cool. All right, let's go to our interviews with Stuart and Renee. But before we do, so this podcast is available on iTunes, SoundCloud, our website, and through our Hey What Did I Miss email. But thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for subscribing. Make sure you're telling your friends and family about it so they can know what platforms we are available on. Make sure you leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. Really helps us out with the rankings. And yeah, Nina, how can people become a member?
Well,
if
you want to be a member, just visit our website, ipa.org.au, and click on the join button. And starting as low as $22 per year, you'll become a part of the loudest voice of freedom in Australia.
Now, it also struck me this morning that we would have a lot of listeners who are already members of the IPA.
Yes.
But they would like to support the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And they might like to support some of the stuff we do around it. Maybe they listen to Renee, they listen to Stuart, and they think, I really want to help the IPA. Where can people who are already members go to help out the IPA?
Just click on that donation button or the join button as well. Probably you want to give someone special who hasn't become a member and ask them to join and become a member.
Cool. So join or donate to the IPA. Let's go to those interviews now. Okay, we're now joined on the show once again, one of our favourites, IPA Campus Coordinator Renee Gorman. Renee, welcome back to the show.
Hi guys, thanks for having me on again.
The award-winning Campus Coordinator, which we'll get into later.
We'll get into later, but first off, so last few weeks, the IPA has been running a series of debates across the country at university campuses, capitalism v socialism.
Yes.
Now, Renee, you were at our last one at the University of Sydney with the research fellow Matthew Lesh, capitalism v socialism, the biggest debate of our time. What did you see? How did it go?
It was a bit of a mixed bag. So it was a really great night for our side, and we signed up a lot of people to Generation Liberty, which was awesome. But Sydney socialists, we learned, are a little bit more crazy than Melbourne and all the other shows.
Really?
And it got a bit intense at some times, but it was a good night overall.
I'm surprised that the Sydney socialists were more crazy than the Melbourne socialists.
Yeah, because Melbourne socialists tend to be pretty crazy.
These guys were a new level. Even Matthew Lesh was saying these guys are like a cult. They're the worst we've ever dealt with. They cheered at the deaths of millions. They cheered at the idea of Matthew Lesh being killed. It was pretty crazy.
Well, that's just good socialism from, their perspective. But let's get into it. So what were the arguments they were making? What were the arguments you were making? What did you think the audience was resonating with?
So, again, they never really defined what their version of socialism really was. They said that it would be kind of some radical democracy where every decision came down to a kind of town meeting, which I didn't really understand how that was going to work.
Yeah, that country would be very easy to invade.
Yeah, they used the whole that's not real socialism argument, of course, denied all the atrocities in the past. Well, our main argument was, capitalism is a great thing. It's a poverty-fighting machine, and it has brought so many people out of poverty, so we need to continue free market economics if we want to end poverty. And, they kept yelling at us about, how dare you think it's okay for people to live at $1.80 a day? And it's like, $1.80 is better than zero.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
Apparently there's a huge crowd, Renee, which is great to see, a big crowd of young people come and listen to a debate about ideas.
Yeah. It was a really nice big crowd. I think went up to about 350 people, which was really good to see come out. I think that's one of the biggest events that's happened on Sydney University as a student event for a very, very long time.
That's awesome.
Yeah, very cool. And also, we had a few thousand people watching online, and there's a highlights video which Renee's put together. You can look at that on the Generation Liberty Facebook page. And you can also chuck it a like if you haven't already, and also the IPA Facebook page. And I think the full debate is still up, but it's just hidden from the timeline. So if you want to hunt through the videos and watch it. But Renee, I want to get the idea, like, what was the most laughable thing you heard the socialists say as an argument for socialism or against capitalism? But like, what was the one moment where with just absolute facepalm, hitting your head against the table kind of thing you heard?
Oh, just the last speaker for the socialists just kept saying that Matthew Lesh shouldn't have his degree from the London School of Economics, even though he topped his class, saying that, well, they must have very low standards because he doesn't understand economics. He's so stupid, but then wouldn't explain economics.
Mm.
It's like, that's not how you debate. You don't just call someone stupid and then not explain why.
I find that pretty effective. It's got me out of a lot of tight spots in my time.
And also one, their chairperson, who was just supposed to introduce the topic and introduce their team, A, didn't state the topic clearly, so I had to say it at the beginning of the debate. And also, when she went to introduce the team, went on like a 10-minute rant. And we're like, you're not a speaker. And we had Ken had tried to pull her down, and she was just going on and on and on. We're like, you're a chairperson, not a debater. So they just didn't play by the rules either. They just were making up their own rules as they go.
Did the chairperson know that the thing was being filmed? Because that is a poison chalice. You tell someone that doesn't get filmed a lot that they're being filmed, and you have to write off the next 25 minutes of your life. Like, they'll milk that for all that it's worth.
Yeah, I think she was aware that it was being filmed. She was also like 45. Ranting to these students. So I was like, what are you doing here? This is a student event. Why did they get you as a chairperson? It was such a strange moment. Everyone's like, why would she sit down?
Yeah, she went off the reservation. She had the crowd. No one was going to get up and tell her to sit down. So until that happened, it was all hers.
Yeah. No, she got booed off in the end.
All right, so that's overall, of course, the debate series through the course of Australia was a great success. So well done, Renee, on that. We'll move on to...
We've had a whole lot of new members, and if you do want to sign up, you can go to... What's the website again, Nina?
What's the...
APA.org.au.
That's the one.
Difficult to remember. Yeah. Okay, so moving on to a new topic, we've seen this week in the news, the Australian College of the Arts putting on this play where they racially segregate people before going into the play. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that and how that is actually not that potentially not that uncommon, this kind of thing happening at universities.
Yeah, so pretty much the case is that someone's putting on a dance performance, and before the performance begins, the crowd is separated into white and what they call coloured people, which is pretty much everything that isn't white, which is it's just an Americanism which is creeping into the Australian language, which I find very interesting. I find it's kind of typical of this kind of copycat SJW stuff. They're just trying to be like America. And it's caused a big uproar because the white patrons didn't get to see, I think, any of the performance, even though they paid for a ticket and had to be lectured to and sign a contract. Or sign a piece of paper that they were going to acknowledge their white privilege. It was very, very strange.
So what do you make of that? Like, as the idea of, like, this is a bunch of students going together going, this is helping racial equality.
Well, I really don't think that this fighting segregation and racism with racism and segregation makes absolutely no sense to me. People have been calling this reverse segregation. I'm like, it's not reverse segregation. It's just segregation. So it's seems like not as the solution to the problem and very kind of tied into these postmodernist ideas of power. Also, I really hated the teachers that came out like, we're not going to censor our students. I did an arts degree. Like, I did visual arts subjects. They censored students all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. So,
like, a friend of mine did a really beautiful painting of her gay friend in a rainbow, like, Indian headdress, like one of the costume shop ones that was bright rainbow. And she got that taken off display because it was cultural appropriation.
Really?
And I had another friend who did an artwork on the Cambodian killing fields, and she almost got censored, and she got a very low mark because she wasn't Cambodian. She wasn't allowed to talk about that.
Is that right? See, because I sort of feel like this, a play that wants to explore racism in isolation is like not such a terrible thing. But it's the fact that it's only ever one angle that's kind of examined, and it's only one. You know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah.
What am I trying to say, James?
Well,
No, like
as Pete's official interpreter. But it's also like, you know, if a student wants to put on this play, like we said earlier in the show, if a student wants to put on this play and do it, then, you know,
feel your
go ahead. Feel your roots, go do art. But it's the second the university's like, this is a good idea, have it at our lecture halls and theatres and stuff, that's when it gets a little weird because the university's kind of co-opting, like, this is a good thing.
Yeah, of course. Like, I'm totally for freedom of expression. If she wants to do this in a private venue and pay for it herself, and also that the consumers that go in there are completely aware of what's about to happen or have some idea, then, yeah, that's fine. But right now it's being funded by the taxpayer, and that just doesn't seem acceptable.
Cool. We'll move on to another story, and I'm kind of liking Renee's sort of the... When Pete and I see a few different stories of universities going a bit wild, we're just like, let's get Renee on the phone and get to the bottom of this.
She's our crazy stuff at university spokesperson.
Yeah, our correspondent. Cool. So we've also had another professor at a university, Dirk Moses. Last week compared columnist Greg Sheridan to mass murderer Anders Breivik, basically on one's right wing and the other's right wing, therefore they're the same. John Roskam, executive director here at the IPA, made the point in his email that if professors were willing to say like this on ABC websites, which is where the comments appeared, who knows what gets said behind the walls of a university lecture or just in a tute or something like that. As a student, what's your take on the story, and do you have any examples of similar things being said?
Yeah, well, the story is not surprising to me that someone would say that, because you do hear crazy stuff like that in university all the time. In my first year of my master's, I was in a PR class where my teacher compared mining lobbyists to people who defend the mining industry to Nazis.
Right.
And I'm like, what?
Yeah, was there a causal link that she saw that she explained?
Well, he explained, you know, all these mining lobbyists are doing are lying, and they just want to do this for corporate reasons. It's not that they're, you know, trying to protect workers. It's just that they're evil corporatists. And I said, well, I know people who work in this industry, and, you know, maybe they just have a different opinion to you. And he's like, yeah, I guess. I think, I mean, the Nazis thought they were doing good things.
Wow.
What? What? That's just absolutely insane. I literally just said, that is the most, I literally said to his face, that is completely uncalled for and ridiculous.
Yeah,
that he'd moved on.
That is such a good story. So one final thing we want to discuss. So we've been talking about it on the podcast for a few weeks. We've had a few interviews from the Freedman Conference run by our friends at the Australian Libertarian Society. Big conference and big awards night. Now, we had Dr. Chris Berg, who won Libertarian of the Year, I want to say.
I think so.
And now we have Renee, who was awarded the Young Libertarian Activist of the Year at the Freedman Conference. That must have been pretty cool. So did you thank us in your acceptance speech? I know this podcast has been quite big at getting you out into the mainstream. So do you dedicate it to us? Do we get to hold it? What's the deal?
Actually, it was Libertarian Activist of the Year. Didn't have Young on there. I beat all the activists, including the old one.
That's good.
I was completely in shock. I didn't expect it at all. There's footage that my friend filmed of me getting up, but it's just me being like almost crying, half laughing, getting up. And my acceptance speech was kind of incoherent. And a very funny moment afterwards was I'm holding my award and I step back and I'm next to Chris Berg and I'm like, turn to him and I'm like, I didn't expect this at all. And he looks at me and he looks at his award and he's like, I expected this.
That is the most Chris Berg thing I've ever heard.
What did you ever? Yeah. Have you talked about him about that with him since then?
I think I have, but yeah, I just started laughing. I'm like, I love you, Berg.
Was he like, because they told me so I would write a speech, or does he just like, it's my time?
He's deserved that award for a very long time.
The man
writes like what, 18 books a year on liberty. I think he deserved the award.
It's actually his Facebook is just like every week there's a book.
Yeah. My husband's a historian. He's actually a research fellow with the IPA as well. And he always looks at Berg putting out all this stuff. And he's like, how does he have time?
Yeah. If you want to feel lazy, add Chris on Facebook.
Yeah,
it's a journey.
You know, enough about Berg. Let's hear about Renee's.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay? Like, Renee's been on telly.
Yep.
She's been the face of. What have you been on the project?
I've been on the project. I've been on Bolt. I've been on ABC, I've been on quite a few radio shows.
This podcast.
Yeah, no, this podcast.
Obviously, we're joking.
I've also did some screening for a documentary, so that'll be interesting as
That's
well.
That's very cool.
I saw you had comments in The Guardian.
Oh, yes, I did. I did do an interview with a Guardian journalist who did actually quote me accurately, which was great.
Wow. Okay, that's the first time that's happened to us. No, they're good on privacy laws. They're good with us. Yep. Anyway, Renee, what do you reckon, out of your year of scalps that you've taken at various universities, what's been your favourite over the last year? Like, obviously, this is an award given to you because you've done a lot of great work defending the cause of liberty. What was your favourite moment from the last year of stuff you were doing?
Probably when we came out during the case for coal, when they were saying, you know, you have to pay whatever security fees we deem like necessary, and we can slap them on you at any time. And then we went to the media and told everyone what was happening. And then they just never contacted me again, and there was no security fee, and they just quietly went away. And then this recent event, there wasn't even a discussion about a security fee. And I'm like, you have learned your lesson.
Do not mess with Renee. Cool. So, Renee, we've got a lot of listeners out there. They're young people. They're sort of one foot in the water on politics, I guess, and they're sort of looking for a more activist role. Now, as someone who is the Libertarian Activist of the Year, you're sort of a trailblazer for a lot of young people out there. What advice would you give to someone who's just sort of getting into politics or just starting at university and wants to get more involved in the cause?
I'm going to show my Jordan Peterson roots and say definitely speak the truth. I think that is the most important thing. My life completely changed when I decided that I wasn't going to stay quiet and I was going to speak the truth of what I believed and what I thought was right. Also, focus on topics that you're passionate about, that you have some connection to, and don't be afraid of showing emotion with it. I think our side sometimes lacks the emotive side of the argument. So I think if you can tap into that a little bit, it's going to make people gravitate towards you.
That's really interesting, Renee. When you described that thing where you said, I had this moment I was going to speak the truth anymore, do you remember actually consciously making that decision, and do you know why?
So it was this was before I was with the IPA. I had watched the film The Red Pill and decided I was going to screen it on campus, and I had so many people telling me not to do it and that I was going to, start this trouble and that I was going to get attacked for it and blah, 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 blah. And I said, no, I'm not going to give in to bullies. I remember thinking at that moment, I'm like, I'm not a political hack. I'm not going to toe the party line. I'm not going to do what everyone else tells me to do. I'm going to fight for free speech.
Very cool.
Renee
Gorman, campus coordinator. Make sure you like Generation Liberty on Facebook. Make sure you are a member of the IPA if you want to keep up to date with Generation Liberty events. Renee, thanks so much. We'll call you next time university loses its mind, which will be 2 days.
Yeah, cool. See That'll you. Be very soon.
All right, bye.
Bye.
Okay, we now welcome back onto the show the IPA's Director of Strategic Communications and External Affairs, also my manager, Stuart Eaton. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, James.
Disco hey, Stu.
Nina, nice to be
as
here.
As he's known around the traps.
By you. So, Stu, huge few weeks for you here at the and huge few weeks for the IPA. So, I want to start off with this one. So, late last month, you helped organise the book launch for Australia's Red Tape Crisis, one of the books written by some IPA research fellows here, Dr. Darcy Allen and Dr. Chris Berg, great friends of the show. And people out there, if you do want to get the book, that's available on Connacourt online. Now, the book launch was in Canberra.
Yep.
We had, there was a few policymakers are there. What did you see at the book launch? What were you sort of thinking?
Yeah, I think there was probably a few great aspects to the book launch. Yeah. Obviously, the book itself is a great publication in terms of how it sets out the problem that Australia is facing with red tape and some potential ways forward, as well as how we've ended up in this situation overall. But the importance of it was that the book was launched by the Minister for Small Business and Workplace Relations, Craig Laundy, and he's pretty new in the portfolio, but he's a guy who's had a lot of private sector experience. His family's had a lot of private sector experience in hospitality. And so he gave a really great speech launching the book on real examples of red tape and what it's doing and what the government is committed to doing to overcome it. And I think it was important to have him there because he actually has a bit of investment in it. And then in the crowd, we had about another 15 to 20 politicians who are across different parties, but they obviously there's a real commitment to doing something about this and getting Australia moving. So that was important.
That was my next question I was going to ask. What was the cross-party spectrum like? So that's good that there was a few people from different parties.
Yeah, there was. We've been fortunate that IPA has done a lot of work on red tape over the years, and we've actually promoted that across the parliament to a number of different people. And so there's a bit of buy-in now. And it's one of those interesting points in Australia that at the moment there's the government's obviously running a big deficit. Mm-hmm. They don't have money to splurge on things, and they're looking for ways to reinvigorate Australia. And mm-hmm. a good way to do that would be actually to get government out of the way and let people get on with it themselves.
Now, you actually hand-delivered this book to every parliamentarian, isn't that right?
Simon, now he likes to be known now as Brahini. Simon and I actually delivered that to every politician on the day after we'd done the launch, which was great. So there's a lot of interest in the issue, but also there's a lot of practical solutions to it. You know, as people are going and developing policies for the next election, they're looking for something they can take to the public and say, yes, this is something I can do. This is an achievable goal.
So you walked to every office, didn't you?
Yep, we did.
Director of External Comms and Strategy.
Yeah.
Not afraid to get his hands dirty.
Not afraid to get his hands dirty. No, no, no. Great exercise regime as well. So yeah
it was good.
One thing I did see was Dan saying if government departments just reduce spending by 1% per year, the budget being surplus next year.
Yeah, that's
and,
right.
And like, I was just doing that calculations for my own life. Like, that's one. Well, that's just like if I don't order Uber Eats tonight and instead make myself food, like, that's a 1% saving right there. And it's like, it's weird that the government can't find a way to do the same sort of stock take of their sort of.
I guess we're in the fortunate position there when you decide to make your decision about you, that's only one person. Whereas with the government, they've got to try and curtail thousands of people into agreeing to this goal.
I have a lot of advisors for my Friday night dinners.
It's nice to get
a lot of people
to
consult with. There's a lot of party cliques as well.
Yeah,
it's
the Instagram, yes or no, should I have this or should I have that?
Yeah. And it's bitter.
It's nice to get an insight into the life in the curtain. That is the James Bolte experience.
Yeah. Another red tape thing that the IPA has done. So this week, and this is available online, so Dan and Gideon appeared at the Senate Select Committee on Red Tape. Mm-hmm. What did you make of what Dan and Gideon were saying?
Yeah, so obviously the Red Tape Committee was set up by David Lionhelm, who's a senator from New South Wales, and he's from the Liberal Democrats, and he's got a real commitment to less government is a good thing. And so he set up this committee looking at ways to get red tape out of different industries, and he's gone through a number of steps, and at the moment he's looking at occupational licensing. The emphasis and the roadblocks that are putting up to people getting into certain industries. And so Dan and Gideon appeared up there and they talked about why this is an impediment to Australia's economy and to a lot of workers as well. And so basically it is that it's causing a lot of people not to pursue these jobs because they don't have the time to devote to these sorts of things. But also it's sort of based on an older time. I mean, the amount of information that's at our fingertips now that we can get makes sort of a lot of this, you know, irrelevant. I'm much more likely to use the Uber driver who's got 5 stars than I am to use the Uber driver who's got 4.
Yeah, but he has like 5,000 extra trips. Like, yeah, you know, you want the 5-star rating.
Correct. Yeah. But also you want, you've now got that information. Now, I can't get that information about a taxi driver, for example. I don't know the individual taxi driver. And so having sort of people that are licensed now, it's sort of irrelevant because I can get on and type in, you know, James Bolt Plumbing. Is that a good industry? Is that a good company or not?
Terrible. Do not do it.
I'm probably not going to use it. But I can actually find that information now. Whereas in the past, it would have been really difficult.
Yeah.
So there's actually been some great work done overseas on this too. The Institute for Justice in the US has released a number of publications on this, and they've found things like in the US, and I have no idea whether it's the same here, but I imagine it is, that it's harder to get a qualification as a hair braider or an interior designer than it is to be a mica paramedic. And it takes longer and it costs more. And so basically you're keeping out of those keeping people usually from lower incomes out of the industries they want to be in.
Now, if IPA's office scuttlebutt is proved to be correct...
This is dangerous.
I have heard that at this committee there was a somewhat spicy interaction between Gideon and one of the people on the committee. Could you go into that?
I understand that was the case too, with Labor Senator Murray Watt from Queensland. And I understood that the Senator sort of gave Gideon some grief, but not enough that he was particularly concerned about it. Mm-hmm. Didn't think it was a big deal on the day. But subsequently, the Senator has put a number of tweets out saying about I was forced to listen to so-called evidence from the IPA. And again, I mean, I guess with the licensing, it's the flip side to the union equation. All we're trying to do is you know, it's like a, it's similar to a cartel. We're trying to keep people out. So the unions do it with, you've got to have no card, no entry. Yep. But a lot of these industries are doing it because they just want to prop up the costs they can charge people without having more competition.
Yeah, licensing is a huge thing. Actually, in India, India has become a lot, like, it's still very poor, but a lot more prosperous since the early 90s. And the big thing they changed was licensing. Like, their licensing really? Was crazy.
Yeah. Okay.
And they rolled it back a lot in the early 90s, and it's lifted millions of people out of poverty.
Yeah, you also see, like, the story will break every 3 or 4 weeks in the US of just, you know, someone doing hair braiding. And yes. I think Louisiana is a terrible state for it, but yep. you need 10,000 hours of practice. So the police shut down a hair braider who's running it out of her living room.
Yep.
And you just think, like, where's she going to go? Like, she obviously needs the money because she can't afford an office, she's doing it out of her living room.
Yeah.
But 10,000 hours.
Yeah.
Well, I just remember this particular story was a woman, but like 10,000 hours to braid hair is just, yeah, the industry saying, how do we stop competition?
Correct. And it's always these industries just trying to keep people out. It's
There's no, like, Murray Watt was like, there's some good arguments to be made for occupational licensing, but you just see it in practice. It is just the industry groups going, how do we make sure, how do we protect our own necks here? We just stop anyone else coming in.
Just putting the safety argument forward.
Absolutely right. And I think, you know, obviously some groups are going to make arguments that this is a dangerous occupation, you know.
Mm.
Do you want surgeons who don't have any licensing or qualifications? Well, you know, probably not, but you're not going to use those people.
Five-star rating. No.
Yeah, if he does have a 5-star rating.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Dr. Nick. So I, when I was in the States as well, I caught up with the Nevada Policy Research Institute, and they were telling me the example that over there it's actually illegal for you to give interior design advice if you don't have your qualification. So I don't know.
So if you're just at your friend's house and you're like, I reckon that chair would look better over there, that's a crime.
I imagine the police just burst down the door and drag you out screaming.
They come through the chair.
Yeah, that's right.
They've seen the inside of some of those casinos. It's pretty dodgy decorating. So.
Well, apparently that's all licensed, though. That's been approved, that.
Really?
Decorating.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah.
Cool. Well, that brings us on to the next sort of stage of this interview. So your US trip.
Yep.
Now, we'll get into why you were over there in a little bit, the Washington Capitals. But while you were over there, it was the lead up to the North Korean talks.
Mm.
So Pete and I have already discussed it earlier in the show. But what was the sort of vibe in Washington, D.C., where you were about the North Korean talks? Like, what were people thinking?
Mm.
You know, you sort of get the idea that there was a lot of people saying, oh, that shouldn't have happened in the first place. Maybe it's a really good thing. What was the vibe you were picking up?
Yeah, I mean, I guess two things primarily. I was amazed at how many people were aware of it. I mean, because a lot of politics, you know, goes over the heads of 90% of people. But I was amazed at how much people were aware of it, how much I was sort of focused on it. But there was really a sense of, I guess, hope out of it. Through all the talk about Trump and, you know, people have really lowered the expectations of Trump. You know, the Democrats particularly, this guy is not up to it and all the rest of it. Every time he does something half decent, people are amazed. And I think there was a real lot of interest in how it was going to go. But I think more importantly, there was sort of a general positive disposition to the fact that talks were actually happening. And I think we've tried everything else with North Korea. We've, you know, gone tough. Obama went really easy on them.
Yep.
Nothing actually improved.
Called him Rocket Man.
Yep, correct. Yep. And now we've had someone coming in who's a sort of a bit more unpredictable, and he's sort of got them on the hop, and, you know, let's see if it actually works.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. But, all right, so, but let's get into it. So, Stu was over there because his beloved Washington Capitals, the NHL team, ice hockey team, never won the Stanley Cup.
Never.
Constantly get to the playoffs only to fall apart.
Yes.
I think this might be a bad trip down memory lane. They lost 2 Game 7s in the last 2 years, the Pittsburgh Penguins. So they've gone all the way. And
in the grand final?
In the playoffs. So they get there, they get really deep, and then can't finish.
Yeah. And usually finish top of the ladder too. And then they just can't get there.
Bloody Penguins, eh?
And until this year, Stu.
Until this year. Yeah, so, and James has been saying for some time it's the Caps year.
Yeah. And sort of jinx slash reverse jinx, just trying to get under your skin.
Yeah, I think, you know, similar to, I'm a Geelong supporter as well. So, you know, in 2007, I didn't believe it until the final siren went. I didn't really believe it this time either.
You didn't believe it in 2007 until the final siren went? I thought you won that one by like 87 points.
No, it was 120.
119 points we won by. And I had mates at the MCG saying, come for a beer. I was like, no, I'm still staying right here. But the same with these guys. I mean, it was 10 minutes to go in game 5 and they were down 3-2. And it looked like we were going to game 6, which was fine. I had tickets to game 6.
Oh.
But It was amazing to be there to actually see it. I mean, I'll probably never see them win another one. It's taken them 40 years to get this one. And also, you know, they're not going to win one, judging the way they're partying.
Not at all. So, they will win five games next year.
But there was a moment there where Smith Pelly sort of got this ridiculous goal in the last term, and he was, you know, horizontal when it went through. And that was it. That was the turning point. And it was great to be there. But, I mean, a great effort as well by Vegas. I mean, they're a new team.
Expansion
first
team,
year,
yeah.
They're there. And they've been, you know, they've really brought the city together. I think, the timing with when it started just after the terrible shooting I had in Vegas a year ago was quite fortuitous in a way. But also I was amazed by speaking to just people in shops and that sort of stuff, you know, if we moved a team in the AFL, mainly your supporters would say, well, no, I'm not getting behind that. Or if a whole new team set up like GWS, trying to develop that support for a new team is really difficult. These guys all got involved. And I was saying to people, so did you barrack for someone before? No, this is the first time I've actually ever gone to an ice hockey game. And these new people had just got really involved. And because Vegas has never had a team in anything, there was a real momentum behind it. So it's pretty special, actually, over there.
Yeah, it's a breath of fresh air to the other ones because there's an NFL team coming over next year and there's always been threats that an NBA team's going to move over there, so that'd be cool.
The Raiders are coming next year and they're not looking forward to it.
No, well, I mean, we're getting into a different sport here, but I fondly love the Oakland Raiders fans. Like, they are insane. Like, Collingwood fans with Essendon fans and also Port Adelaide fans, if you threw them into the Hadron Collider, it would come out as an Oakland Raider fan. But yeah. I'm not a huge hockey guy, but Stanley Cup, the Washington Capitals, led by this guy, Alexander Ovechkin. He's been with the team for 15 years. Mm-hmm. He's the heart and soul of the team. He's this big Russian burly bloke.
Yep.
He is partying it up like no one I've ever seen since he won. He never thought he was going to get there. He's finally at the end of his career. Did you see him at any point in your travels? Because he's running around like swimming in fountains. He's just showing up at baseball games with the cup for no reason.
I'd love to say that I did, but unfortunately I didn't. It was sort of sliding doors. The place where I had breakfast one day, you know, later on in the day, they were all frolicking in the fountain there.
Yeah.
No, I didn't see them. I mean, in Vegas, obviously, there's a lot of sort of private parties that go on in the different clubs in Vegas. So, despite my best efforts, I didn't get any invitations to those. They're having a really... They're really enjoying it. But at the same point in time, the city's really enjoying it too. I mean, DC was pumped. So I got to DC on the Saturday. And, you know, the front of the buses are all go caps. Every store has signs in the window. It was a really great atmosphere.
Yeah.
And people were really still talking about it 2 days later and really enjoying it.
You went, this is like a 4-day trip, wasn't it?
Yep. So,
it's dedication.
So I left on Thursday morning and got into Vegas Thursday afternoon, given time changes and the rest of it. And the game started at 5 o'clock about a week ago, right now, actually. That was fantastic. It was really, really great. Great atmosphere. Vegas is a good town. So it was lucky.
Brilliant. Yeah, let's do it. Thank you so much for joining
us. No worries. Thanks, guys.
Okay. Thank you to Stuart and Renee for those interviews. Really interesting chats. So let's get into some stories and made us laugh from around the world this week. I would like to start, if I may, Pete.
You can.
With one of our favourite segments.
Oh.
And it's new. And it's improved. Straw man arguments.
Look at Nana's face just light up now, with rage.
Straw.
So, that is the word. All right, so this has been a bit of an odyssey for us.
Yeah.
Ever since Pete and I came across the article that said that basically there's a lot of places around the world cracking down on single-use straws. They're saying that straws are a massive pollution problem.
Yep.
And Pete and I found the article that said, I like me saying that we found the article. As if it was up to us.
We uncovered it. We'll look back on our careers and be like, you know, we were saying the things when no one else was saying them.
Except for the people that wrote the article.
Yeah, except for the people that did all the work.
Yeah, so Reason Foundation, or I should probably say Reason.org. Reason, they're a think tank in the US. They are the ones that came across this story. So basically, the idea that single-use plastic straws are an environmental hazard is based on very shoddy data once collected by a 9-year-old as part of a project that was just basically calling a few straw manufacturers and estimating how many straws that the US consumed every year based on those calls.
Yep.
So this
straw... They said there was 500 million a day.
Yep.
No, a year. 500 million a year.
Yeah. So we now have single-use straw bans in California, New York... And where was the other one?
They were talking about one in Toronto.
They were talking about one in Toronto. This kid's work is going around. Now, there's a bit of a social media campaign that has started where you tag people, like sort of like the Ice Bucket Challenge. You tag people in it.
Oh.
Yeah, you remember that?
Yeah.
So you tag people in it and all of you commit to not saying no to straws. This one, Tom Brady, there's been a lot of American sports chat on this podcast. I'm a very happy man. But Tom Brady, quarterback in the New England Patriots, probably the best quarterback to have ever lived, but we'll get into that later. We won't. But he made an Instagram post and talking about how dangerous straws were, including this quote here. Next time you see a plastic straw like this, say, no, I'm not falling for your ruse straw.
Tom
Brady. I don't know if straws are capable of forming ruses, but yeah. To go past that.
Do straws have souls?
Are they Machiavellian? Like, do they have hidden motives?
Did he say the stat?
He didn't say the stat, but it is like...
He's thinking it.
He's thinking it. And where did the stat come from? But basically, it's now going to our sports stars, strawman arguments. This is getting crazy.
How do you feel about that, Nina?
I think this is ridiculous. It's just a straw man.
Because
it's a straw man argument.
I know.
Because you've been a big advocate of this.
Of this.
Like against this.
Yeah. You could not have got that more wrong, Kate.
Well, I mean, I said it. I said against this.
Yeah.
Like against the whole campaign thing, because it's so stupid for me. It was like, there's so much alternative for the straw. Anyway, why do you have to ban a single use straw?
Yeah.
And you can just change the whole thing, not the plastic straw. Use the bamboo straw, people.
No, bamboo straws.
Yeah.
We should start getting money from the Bamboo Straw International.
I
was at a bar.
We're an exam. We're shills for big bamboo.
Can I just get an endorsement of that?
Yeah. All right. Bamboo Straw, get Nina's email. So I was at I was having a post-show drink on Wednesday night at a bar. And Well, I took the straw out of my drink because I don't like straws. So I took the straw out of a rum and coke. And the person behind the bar was like, hey, that's really cool. You're standing up for the environment. And I nearly unleashed the mother of all, well, actually.
You should have. You should have said, well.
I know there's a bit of a line forming behind me, but let me tell you this.
Glad you mentioned that. So you had bars and stuff now. Like, they don't give you a straw. You can grab one yourself.
Anyway, so move on. Pete, do you have one that you want to discuss?
I do. Well, yeah, I do. I wanted to discuss this one. Tonightly with Tom Ballard is a program on the ABC, which during the week, it got leaked to The Australian.
So it's a comedy night show, if you haven't seen it, because not a lot of people have seen it. It's like,
I haven't
look
seen
at the ratings.
It. That's quite snarky.
Oh, I haven't seen it. Have you seen it?
I've seen it through my work.
Okay, yes. So a quick stock take has shown that 0 out of 3 Australians polled.
Well, one.
Well.
That's 33%, which is a massive number for a TV show.
Wow, that's a huge market share.
And I don't even have a TV.
It's a weekly, late night satire show on the ABC, hosted by comedian Tom Ballard.
Yep. What happened was they had so they're recently a stupid lefty ABC show.
Yep.
And they did it like this, you know, brainstorming session, how we're going to become a better program, planning, blah, 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 you know, like we always do. And
never had that meeting.
I was going to ask later what ours would look like, but it got leaked to The Australian.
Yeah.
All this stuff. Strengths. Under strength, tonightly with Tom Ballard. Proud of our work on trans issues and Milo Yiannopoulos. Okay, cool. Jokes about Mark Latham are the strongest part of the show. Imagine if that was...
a damning indictment for the rest of the show.
Jokes about Mark Latham. Yeah. Mark Latham.
One of the titans of the Australian media landscape right now.
You'll see more of those. They're coming up. Weaknesses, and this is quite funny because they are lefty and obsessed with races, we'll get to later. Weaknesses, white male orientated, white writer's room, white performers, also has casting of white stand-ups, casting of white musicians, casting of white guys. It's funny because, this is the ABC.
Yeah, if you think that's a weakness, do not look at the rest of your programs.
All the comedians on the ABC are white men.
Yep, absolutely.
Which is ironic because they hate white men.
News presenters as well, a lot of white men.
Yep.
Yeah.
So that was good. And the challenges, now this is where the real kind of kicker, challenges play more in the racial space. Chinese playoff that we're hugely racist. So let's exacerbate the racial divisions for the lols.
Yeah.
That's pretty bad, isn't it?
I don't think they're aiming for lols. Like, there's no part of this. It's a comedy show. And the producers are trying to scratch their heads going, like, there's absolutely nothing in here saying be more funny.
Yeah.
Like, that should be the number one goal of any comedy show.
The jokes about Mark Latham were pretty good, though.
They were pretty good. But that's, yeah. But opportunity, like, I love how it's a weakness is we're all white, but the opportunity is to play more in the racial space.
Yeah.
And there's no one I'd rather hear comedy from about race than a white man.
Yeah.
No one at all.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And it's like the Chinese playoff that we're usually like, have they got a big Chinese audience or something? Like, who are these Chinese people that are like,
yeah,
oh, I watched Nightly with Tom Bellard. And it also says playing in spaces like class. So, you know, it's good, yeah, because they would have no conception of class.
No.
They'd have no idea that they're the elites and the people they call bogans.
Yeah. Again, like, if there's one person I want to make jokes about class, it is the inner city white male performer Tom Bellard.
Yeah.
Like, that's Australia's foremost comedian on the idea of class.
Give him another billion, I say.
Yep. Cool. Move on to another one?
Yep, let's do it.
Okay, so now we've been talking about the state of London. Not like, obviously, the state, but like the state of it is in like what it's like
we talk
in
about London it
right now.
All the time.
Yep. We had it on the show how it's now the knife capital of the world.
We did.
And the London Mayor Sadiq Khan has finally stood up to what is London's biggest problem. He, in an op-ed published in Tuesday in The Telegraph, Mr. Khan called for an editathon to address the gender imbalance of the popular online encyclopedia, Wikipedia. He cited that just 17% of Wikipedia biographies are about women. So get out there, people.
This, you can say what you want about this guy,
yeah,
but he gets things done.
And he spends time on Wikipedia.
Yeah. How did he work that out? So he's got one of his staff to figure that out. I'll probably just turned up on something.
Yeah, it's probably his staff done by a think tank, and he's like, yep, this is London's biggest problem. We don't have enough Wikipedia entries for women, and we'll just deal with the knife crime if and when it comes up again.
17% is quite low.
It's low. What I like about this, so in his op-ed, he posited that... it's like London's Tech Week, and he opened up an office so people can come in and add a biography to women and then be on their merry way.
Another big problem. Tech Week. It's what, you know, there's no technology in London.
No, not enough. Not enough surveillance technology. So the London mayor posited that there could be fewer female editors of Wikipedia because they lack time, confidence, and knowledge about the editing process. Now, my thing is, why does every single feminist statement always end up as the most sexist thing I've ever heard in my life?
What?
Like, yeah, women are too stupid to know what the editing button in Wikipedia is about.
No, they don't have the confidence to use Wikipedia.
that edit button's a big button, all right? Once you press it, there's no going back.
Yeah,
like, I just... Why?
It's, yeah, well, yeah. And they don't have time because they're doing... What, are they doing their nails, mate?
Yeah. I just like... It's always the best is when some man gets up and says, like, look how woke I am. Look how famous I am. And it immediately falls apart. Nothing made for funny.
Nina's the only one who knows how to operate this machine, so...
Oh, I dabble, but I did also forget to record the first 6 minutes of a Rowan Dean interview a while back.
It was the best 6 minutes of radio we ever did.
Yeah.
In a Wakefield.
Yeah.
Well, that's good, James. The Wikipedia, that's good stat, because I was skeptical about that story.
I told you it was
it's good. It's
good
now. Yeah,
I
yeah,
told
yeah.
you it was good.
I'm on board.
All right, cool. What else you got?
Well, Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey CEO
speaking
of Twitter.
Speaking of trying to be woke.
Yeah, speaking of trying to be woke.
I like this story.
So this guy's obviously Twitter is a cesspool, as we all know. Follow me if you want. And this week, Jack Dorsey apologised for publicising the fact that he ate Chick-fil-A, which is a chicken shop in America, which is very successful, during Pride Month because Chick-fil-A... sponsor charities that oppose gay marriage or give money to charities that oppose gay marriage.
And yeah.
So, you know, this guy that has made his millions from a confected outrage machine, now the victim of confected... Well, maybe not confected outrage, maybe just outrage. But that's funny to me.
Yeah, the guillotine's coming for the revolutionary leaders, I guess.
That's so deep, mate.
Thank you, man. But I just love this, like, this is how exhausting it is to be woke or up to date in 2018. Like, you even have to audit your sandwich collection. Like, that's how far you have to go.
And that's the kind
of
sandwich
the kind of standards you have to hold yourself to.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the kind of sandwich you eat when you're hungover as well.
Yeah.
Like, how hard is that?
Well, Chick-fil-A's closed on Sundays, so it's pretty hard to
is
get
it?
Them if you're hungover. Yeah. Well, again, like, they're really religious.
Friday, mate.
They're really religious.
Yeah, well, that's, yeah. Well, it's hard being woke.
Yeah,
that's why it's called being woke.
Yeah,
because it's being awake, which is hard.
That's very deep, Pete. Wow, this has got really deep all of a sudden.
Yeah.
All right, move on to another one. What else have I got here?
I got something. De Niro.
Yes. All right. So, okay, Like, I tend to be pretty pro-Trump on this podcast. Like, I don't love the guy, but, like, there's so much crap that gets written about him, and I kind of feel like I just have to sort of stand up for when he does a good thing and point it out, because otherwise no one will. This is the kind of stuff that really gets me, though. So, Robert De Niro at the Tony Awards, which is, like, the Oscars for Broadway, said F Trump on stage, and everyone, you know, started whooping and clapping wildly. Because it was such a brave stand against Trump. Like, if you take an anti-Trump stance at the Oscars for Broadway, like, that's the lion's den. You are really standing up to people that are going to rush the stage and try and hit you.
A wildly successful actor, no less.
Yeah, wildly. So, I mean, and what I like is, like, it's the one thing that came out of the Tonys was, like, Robert De Niro hasn't made a good movie in, like, 10 years. Name one.
Oh, I don't know movies.
Exactly. So, saying if
Trump's got nothing.
This should have been just a thing that happened. But Trump just bites on all of this stuff. So, he unleashed two tweets on the, like, just after the G7, just after North Korea. Huge, huge week for Trump.
Yep.
He takes a Twitter. It does put him in a body bag, I have to say. Robert De Niro, a very low IQ individual, has received so many shots to the head by real boxers in movies. I watched him last night and truly believe he might be punched drunk. I guess he doesn't realize the economy is best it's ever been, with unemployment being at an all-time high and many companies coming back to our country. Wake up, punchy.
Yeah.
Okay, first of all...
So what's your beef with this, James?
Well, first of all, like, RIP Robert De Niro. Like, no one's come back from punchy.
Who is that, his nickname?
It is now.
Oh, it is. Okay,
yeah,
yep.
It's like low energy Jeb.
Yep.
But my thing is, like, why bite on that? Like... Why give De Niro the time of day on that?
Because I think people like it.
Do they?
You know what? Yeah. I think Trump's just like the spotlight.
Yeah, but it's just...
he bites on everything.
Yeah, he bites on so much. It's just like he had such a good week and talking to North Korea and stuff like that. But how do you still have your mind occupied by what Robert De Niro said about you at the Tonys?
Well,
I don't get it.
My theory of his tweeting is that it's all purposeful and he knows what he's doing.
Yeah.
So he's like, my punters all love this.
Yeah, I know, but just, I don't know. I don't know, Pete.
Or is he have...
I mean, I don't think it's very presidential.
Or, yeah,
or does he have, like, a secret twin or something that have, like, different personalities? So one's a twin and one's the other one's in the public domain. You never know.
Oh, split personality.
No, probably not. Probably like another second Trump, like who looks similar like him.
But that is an interesting theory.
You never know.
That sounds like a political thriller you could write.
Conspiracy theory there.
Conspiracy theories from Nina. There's a second Trump.
He might have a burner account.
He can't have a burner account because he does all of his things in the open. Like, burner accounts are when you want to tweet at someone but you can't get away with it on your account.
Oh, he doesn't need one.
It's just out in the open. Cool. All right. So that's it for the show. One more thing I do want to ask. We come to Pete as the world expert on soccer. He predicted correctly that Liverpool would win 7-6 on penalties at the Champions League.
Unlucky. Well, Salah got injured.
Yeah. Pete, a World Cup started last night. Russia absolutely trouncing Saudi Arabia. Sorry for spoilers if anyone was waiting out for one.
Had taped it.
Yeah. They really wanted to see Russia win. Any World Cup predictions you want to make?
Well,
that we can hold you to.
See, I've been to the last three World Cups, and as part of my...
Why are you going this time?
Because it's time to grow up. It's time to grow up.
That's never time to grow up.
Nina's face.
It's a young IPA podcast.
Mate. Really?
Nah, I've got to finish my PhD. And look, so I haven't been taking as much of an interest in it as I previously have.
Mm-hmm.
I thought Spain were going to be pretty good, but they've just been their manager.
Yeah, I saw that. That's a bit weird.
But I think France are favourites, and we play them first up.
Any for Belgium? That's like the popular smoky prediction is Belgium.
Oh, yeah, hipsters. Yeah. I don't know.
Me. All right, cool. That's it for this week's podcast. Thanks so much for listening. Thank you so much for downloading and subscribing. Available on iTunes, SoundCloud, our website, through our Hey, What Did I Miss email. It's all there for you. Make sure you download it. Make sure you're telling your friends and family. Make sure you're leaving a 5-star review on iTunes if you think the podcast deserves it.
We deserve it.
I do think it deserves it. You know, 50-50 on it, but we'll see. And Nina, if people want to become more active and part of the IPA, if they want to become a member of the IPA, where can they go?
Just visit the website, ipa.org.au, and click on the join button. And starting as low as $22, you can become a part of the loudest voice of freedom in Australia.
And also on our website, you can donate if you want to support the podcast, if you want to see IPA do more podcasts, or if you want to help the IPA do other things
You might think.
We don't want to encourage that.
You might give us money to stop.
I really enjoy the podcast. I don't want to stop.
Yeah.
Cool. See you guys next week.
See ya.